For this morning, the two sessions this morning, I want to talk about the pastor's person and the emotional hazards of the ministry. And if you would turn, please, to 2 Corinthians chapter 1. And I will, several times over these 2 days, be making reference to this portion in 2 Corinthians, because it is these first 6 chapters of 2 Corinthians, where I believe the Apostle Paul clearly sets out for us, unequivocally, his theology of ministry. Now, I happen to believe that if you haven't worked out a theology of ministry, I suggest you get out of ministry. You will not survive in ministry if you haven't charted for yourself a theology that undergirds what you do. I was rather appalled a week ago now, it is, teaching at another seminary in Sydney. I won't mention the name, but a large group of students and postgraduate students, and then a number of students who are taking our Doctor of Ministry class. I was quite alarmed when, during some discussion time I had with the Doctor of Ministry group of students, who are the mature ministers who are continuing their education, I was very alarmed to hear some of them say things like, you know, I don't really have a purpose-driven ministry. I was challenging them about whether their ministry was purpose-driven. Not goal-driven. Oh, it's a good point of emphasis. Not goal-driven. There's a difference between being goal-driven and being purpose-driven. I mean purpose-driven. Is your ministry purpose-driven? And they were saying, no, not really. I said, does your denomination have a well-developed purpose? They just shook their heads. I think that's appalling. At least at the personal level, forget about the denomination. At least at the personal level, there needs to be a purpose that drives you. And that's what I mean by a theology of ministry. And so here in the first 6 chapters of 2 Corinthians, if you want to, at your leisure, take these 6 chapters and study them, I would commend them to you, because the Apostle Paul articulates for us as clearly as I think he could have his theology of ministry. And he begins in verse 3 of chapter 1. Praise be to the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Father of compassion and the God of all comfort, who comforts us in all our troubles, so that we can comfort those in any trouble with the comfort we ourselves have received from Christ. Then verse 8. We do not want you to be uninformed, brothers and sisters, about the hardships we suffered in the province of Asia. We were under great pressure, far beyond our ability to endure, so that we despaired even of life. Indeed, in our hearts, we felt the sentence of death. Now, you could continue to read that at your leisure, the first 6 chapters of 2 Corinthians, and you will discover that there are two themes there. There are two themes, and I think that these are the two themes that drive the Apostle Paul's theology of ministry. The first theme is this, and we have it there in verse 3 onwards. Praise be to the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Father of compassion and the God of all comfort, who comforts us in all our troubles so that we can comfort those in any trouble. What is ministry about? Ministry is about receiving comfort and passing it on to others. Receiving comfort and passing it on. If you don't receive comfort, you have nothing to pass on. And our pulpits, brothers and sisters, our pulpits throughout this land, throughout the rest of the world, our pulpits throughout this world are full of those who preach the gospel and don't know the first thing about receiving of comfort. That's Paul's first principle. The principle is this: if you don't Find comfort for yourself. You have nothing to pass on to others. The relevance of this will become obvious when I move into the whole issue of our own healing and who we are as persons. But the second principle, and it follows through in these six chapters, is this, that ministry is all about dying. It's all about dying. When you went into this profession, when you responded to this call, to the call of God, you should have done so consciously knowing that you were going to die. It's all about dying. But the question I want to raise with you today is this. Are you dying in the right way? Are you dying too fast? Are you dying in the way that God intended it? Indeed, in our hearts, we felt the sentence of death. Go over to chapter 4. The beautiful words, verse 10 of chapter 4. We always carry around in our body the death of Jesus. That's what ministry is about. But read on. So that the life of Jesus may also be revealed in our body. Some of us know how to die. We don't know how to live. Some of us are accelerating our dying. Some of us confuse burning out, and I use that phrase in a sort of positive connotation, although it also has a negative one. Many confuse burning out, which I see as a controlled giving up of myself in service. We confuse that with wasting out. And there's a very, very important difference between the two. And those two themes are what I'm about this morning. Receiving comfort, so we can pass it on. Dying in the right way. Dying in a way that is paradoxical, because in the dying one does for Christ in ministry, one is renewed and has life. And if you don't have life, at the end of the day, at the end of the week, then there's something not right in your ministry. So that's my direction for this morning. But let me begin. Let me start. Last night I sort of gave a little introduction to my topic, which I threw out the challenge. You know, who are you as a person? And I mentioned, I'm now on point one of the outline, in case you don't know where I am, that the greatest challenge facing the church today, and especially as we go into the next millennium, the greatest challenge facing the church is not church growth, but church health. And I want to mention that there have been four significant movements in the church in America. And movements that I believe and I know have also impacted significantly the Australian scene. Let me just review them for you quickly to set the stage for the fifth movement, which is the movement I believe that has now begun and into which we are now moving. There are four significant movements that have impacted the church for the last 25 years. And nothing I want to say about these is intended to be critical, although every one of them has had its downfallings. The first movement, the very first significant movement, starting about 1970-71, is the church growth movement. Fuller established a School of World Mission and church growth, one of our three schools. The other is the School of Psychology that I was the dean of, and then the School of Psychology, and then the School of Theology. But about that time, Donald McGavran, late 60s, became fairly prominently known and began to preach the idea that deliberate intentional planning and planting and marketing and having user-friendly facilities. All of this facilitates church growth. And it was a significant movement. It gave birth to the phenomenon we now know as the mega church movement. And it revived, it mobilized the church in a way that it had a very, very significant impact. It is my observation as I travel around the United States particularly that the church growth movement is now waning. Wherever I go, I encounter scores and scores of pastors who, with tears streaming down their faces, say things like, "I did everything according to the book. I followed every single principle. Nothing happened. Nothing happened." So the issue, you see, is not the idea that one shouldn't grow a church, but some of the mistakes that were made would be to reduce church growth down to a set of techniques. And so that movement is starting to wax now. And a lot of disillusionment has set in. The mega church itself has become a significant problem. Many of you will probably know Rick Warren and the Saddleback Community Church is a church I know very well. Rick's a former student of mine, known him for years. I get to preach for him every summer. In fact, I think he was here about a year and a half or so ago. While he was here, I was preaching for him at Saddleback. I was holding the fort. It's a church that I have the greatest respect for. I'll make mention of it later. But it is probably one of the few mega churches. And I think when I preached there last July, I think I preached to like 12,000 people. They moved into their new premises, and suddenly it's now 14,000. I go and preach again this coming July, and I wouldn't be a bit surprised if it's 16 or 17,000 people. A phenomenal movement. And it is one of the few exceptions, but most of the mega churches in the United States today have become self-sufficient to the extent that they've become closed systems. And the mega church movement, in mega church movement, they're saying things like, "Well, you know, we're big enough, we don't need seminaries. We can train our own, we can develop our own stuff. We don't need to send our young people out to colleges and other places to get training. We can train them ourselves." And what that is breeding, now listen to this carefully. I say this with love and concern, not with criticism. Because I know most of the leaders of these mega churches and I am in dialogue with them. But I say this with great concern, that it is breeding an incestuous church that is a closed system that has no input from the outside, no accountability on the outside. Even denominational accountabilities are cut off. If we need denominations for one reason and one reason only, is to get the local church not to be incestuous. And I don't care how you structure the denomination, but don't take denominations away from me. I value every single one of them, because of that very significant responsibility, the role that they play in holding local churches accountable to a larger body of believers. And the mega church is moving away from that. Pleased to see that Rick Warren has moved significantly in the last year or two to a stronger affiliation with his Baptist denomination and a stronger identification there. So that's the church growth movement. That's the first significant movement. We could spend all morning just talking about that, but I have other purposes in mind. The second significant movement that has hit us in the last 25 years, making a significant impact, is the small growth movement. Now, to counteract the large church or the mega church movement, we had to develop small group movement. We had to compensate for our bigness by making our bigness down into little smaller groups again. And that's a very significant one. Two people at Fuller, who contributed to that, Roberta Hess, and this, I thought, made a significant contribution there. We now have a faculty member, an old friend of mine, and we've known each other for 35 years. Dick Peace, Richard Peace, is now at Fuller and an expert in that. Lay-led small groups, leadership training, the expansion of ministries through decentralized leadership. All good stuff. And no large church can survive without it. No small church can survive without it. What was its weakness? Its weakness was that it was primarily lay-led. And if your lay leaders are not trained properly, what you get is a bunch of gobbledygook theology is what you get. You get all the quirks and idiosyncrasies of the local leaders expressing themselves through those little small groups. And so instead of the small group contributing to the large group, small group becomes splinter groups. That's the danger in some of those. Not all. Thank God. The third movement we've seen is the contemporary worship movement. We have evidence of that on this platform here today. 25 years ago, you would not have had a band on this platform. You'd have had maybe a piano, and that's it. But the contemporary worship movement, concentrated on corporate worship, fresh forms of praise music. And I have the greatest respect for my Pentecostal friends. I have a few wonderful, wonderful friends. Jack Hayford, who is well known in the United States, is a personal friend, and I have a son-in-law who's ordained in that denomination, the Four Square denomination. So we get a lot of exposure to Pentecostal worship style, and I have just such an appreciation for contemporary worship music. The freeing up of congregations to praise and to sing praise and to pray prayers of praise right there. Baptists maybe are still lagging a little bit behind in that regard, but contemporary worship is now an important part of our tradition. What's its downside? The downside is we've thrown away a lot of music that through the ages has been God-inspired. You mean to tell me that some of the stuff we sing today is better than that? I have serious doubts. You know, and our large seminary, and our Fuller Seminary, is what, 3,500 students. One of our biggest problems is that only a small percentage of the students in our seminary know any of the traditional hymns. And so we have to sing them every now and again in worship service, you know, just so they can learn them and discover what rich spiritual resources they are. That's the third movement. A good movement, but also with some downside. Then the fourth movement was the seeker-sensitive movement. I suppose Bill Hybels would be the best example. The seeker-sensitive movement, focused on cultural relevance, specially designed seeker events, evangelism training, new believer discipleship. Wonderful, wonderful stuff. Its downside? Well, many worship services have degenerated into entertainment displays. You know, I have serious problems, frankly, when I look at a lot of what's going on driven by seeker sensitive. You know, I wonder whether worship is slowly degenerating into entertainment. It wasn't intended to be. You go to church to get a fix, an adrenaline fix. You may as well have watched the footy game last night. Gives you a better fix than most church services. But I think we have difficulty telling the difference between adrenaline and the spirit sometimes. These are all good movements, but there's a fifth movement, the one I began to talk about last night, and that's the healthy church movement. And if I would put Rick Warren and Rick Warren's ministry and church anyway, I would put it right at this point. The healthy church movement. Healthy churches grow. Churches that pay attention to the healing of people emotionally, personally, all aspects of their being. Those churches grow. People are drawn to them. And that's the movement that I think is the movement to which we must now begin to turn. And last night I asked the question, how healthy is the church? No, it's not very healthy. Not very healthy. And then the more important question is, how healthy is the pastor? And that's what we're about today. How healthy is the pastor? Because the health of the church is a direct reflection of the health of the pastor. And I'm going to come back to that theme several times. But there are three images that I want to share with you. Three images. I hope that God burns them into your mind. The first image comes from a play by Thornton Wilder called The Angel That Troubled the Waters. Thornton Wilder, playwright in the early part of the century, American playwright, wrote a number of plays with wonderful moral principles. And this particular play, The Angel That Troubled the Waters, is based on the story in John 5, the pool of Bethesda. The pool near the sheep gate, where the sick, the lame would gather, waiting for the angel to move the water, because the moment, whenever the angel moved the water, whoever was in first was healed. Jesus, as you remember, came upon this pool, and a man sitting there who saw Jesus and said to Jesus, you know, I don't have anyone to carry me and put me in the pool when the water is troubled. I'm sure he was saying that to Jesus as a sort of subtle hint. Wouldn't you like to sort of hang around for a while? And the next time that water gets moved, only once a month or maybe only once a year, who knows how often it happened, but hang around a little bit and pick me up when it's moved and get me in there first. And Jesus said, get up. Take up your bed and walk. You're healed. And it's that story that Thornton Wilder uses for his play, The Angel That Troubled the Waters. But the play is about the people gathered around this pool. More of a modern pool. All sorts of people. It's about the play is about their individual lives. And one of the men around that pool is a physician in a deep, deep depression. Horrible depression. So horrible, so he is so lethargic that when the pool is troubled, he can't get up fast enough. His limbs won't move quickly enough, and so someone else is always in the pool before him. One day, by sheer fluke, the water is troubled, and the physician is up, and he's at the pool's edge, and he is about to put his foot into the pool when suddenly a loud voice shouts out, stop, stop, hold back. This healing is not for you, it says. And the physician stumbles back in dismay at this voice. And then the voice says these words to the physician, in love's service only the wounded soldier can serve. Oh, I'm so moved by that. In love's service, only the wounded soldier can serve. Draw back. This healing is not for you. It's a wonderful image. Only the wounded soldier can serve. In God's service, only the wounded can serve. Now, that's not true of the nation service, is it? Or the military service? When your wounded soldiers have no place for. My father, I remember as a young boy, very young boy, my father signing up for the Second World War. The Transvaal Scottish. I remember his kilt. Just as if it were just yesterday. I remember his kilt. And his little, what they call that thing in front? Spurn. And he went into training, and 3 months later he broke his leg They gave him a medal and said, thank you for your service, but we can no longer use you. That's what the world does to its wounded. But this image from Thornton Wilder's play says this to me. It says this to me that the foremost qualification for effective ministry is that one is wounded. Or better still, that one acknowledges one's woundedness. Because woundedness is a given. We're all wounded. In God's service, only the wounded can serve. Now, to acknowledge one's woundedness takes a radical personal integrity. And so my first challenge to you is this. Are you willing to own that woundedness? You are, whether you acknowledge it or not, you are wounded. Are you willing to acknowledge it? You do, because only then can you begin to receive that comfort that comes from God. And the reason why there are so many in our pulpits today who have no comfort to give is because to begin with, they're not willing to own their woundedness. That's the first image. The second image comes from Henry Nouwen. He tells the story in one of his little books. I mean, this is a man who just has to mumble a few words and someone will write them down. And the next thing, it'll be a book that'll sell in the millions. He writes little books, 20 pages, 30 pages long. I've got to turn in 400 pages before a publisher will even look at mine. And he's 20, 30 pages, and it's published and sells in the millions. But he tells the story of an old legend from the Talmud. An old legend from the Talmud. Where Rabbi Joshua ben Levi is on a journey. I love Jewish stories. In fact, I love everything Jewish. I suspect that somewhere way back, my blood got contaminated with some Jewish blood. Because it seems to be in my genes. My oldest daughter has got this fascination with everything Jewish also. I love Jewish jokes. I love being around rabbis. I love the way they think. I love their logic. It's just fascinating. But in this Talmud, the Rabbi Joshua ben Levi is on a journey. He's on a quest. He's looking for the Messiah. And again, you know, put on Steven Spielberg mind. You can see the old man with his crooked stick in olden times walking along the path. And he comes to the entrance of a cave. And at the entrance of the cave, sitting there, he recognizes the prophet Elijah. And so he goes up and says to the prophet, Master, when is the Messiah coming? And Elijah looks up, taken by surprise, and he says to the old rabbi, well, why don't you ask him yourself? But where is he? Where is the Messiah? And Elijah says, well, it's very simple. You just follow this path down the side of the hill, down to the city there in the valley. And outside the gate, the main gate, you will find a crowd of people, mainly sick and lame and poor, but right in the middle of that crowd, you'll find the Messiah. So the old rabbi thanks him and starts on his way down the side of the hill, slowly, painfully, till finally he comes to the outskirts of this group of people. Impatiently with his stick, he knocks to make a pathway through and sort of works his way through the outside of the crowd. The stench is something horrible to experience. He looks at the sick and the outcast of the city. And finally he comes to the center of this group of people, and there sitting on a rock, he recognizes the Messiah. And he stands there to observe for a while. And what he notices is this, that the Messiah is sitting on the rock, binding his wounds. But every now and again is interrupted by someone who needs help, maybe a healing.
And the Messiah interrupts what he's doing and he attends to the needy person and then goes back to binding his own wounds. And as the rabbi stands and observes, this is the legend in the Talmud, the Messiah is always binding his wounds, but being interrupted so much that he never gets to the end of binding his own wounds. And Henry Nouwen has borrowed that story to coin for us the phrase, the wounded healer. So the first story you see is, woundedness is the prerequisite to service. But the second story takes it a step further. It's not woundedness in and of itself. It's the wounded healer. It is the healer. It is the wounded being healed. It's in the process of being healed. How can we be a source of healing if we ourselves are not being healed? Never comes to the end of his own healing. Never. And so it is with the pastor. The pastor's wounds, as they are healed, become the source of healing for others. Effective preaching is preaching about what you have personally experienced. Nothing else. Third image. I'm indebted to Scott Peck for this image. Scott, in recent years, I don't know how many of you know this, after his success with The Road Less Traveled, has moved on and has become more and more conservative in his Christian position. About a year and a half ago now, I received a phone call one day out of the blue. The person on the other side said, "Is that Dr. Hart?" I said, "Yes." He said, "I'm Scott Peck." I was taken a bit by surprise. He said to me something like, very humbly, "You may know who I am." I said, "Sure, I know who you are." He said, "Well, I tell you why I'm calling." He said, I'm thinking of going into semi-retirement, and I have a huge, huge supply of manuscripts and awards and what we'd call in the States, we refer to it as an archive, books, papers, letters, documents." He says, "And I've been approached by Harvard University School of Divinity to donate my archives to them. But I've been sitting here thinking that I think Fuller would be a better place than Harvard." And I said, "I think so too." And so as the conversation went on, he was just checking us out. "Would we be willing to be the recipients of his archives?" I said, "Gladly." Ran over to our president and said, "You know, there are times, Mr. President, when I make decisions for you. And this is one of those decisions I have made for you, and that is, we will be the recipients of Scott Peck's archives." And the president, sort of stunned, said, "But do you know his theology? Are you sure that he's..." And on and on and on and I'm and on and on. Yeah. What number do I dial to get a microphone? We're going to change. We've got a loose. That one's on. Oh, I'm on. Yes, thank you. Well, where was I? Telling the president that I'd made this decision for him. And I said, "No, I've had it on several sources and from my conversations with Scott Peck. This is a man who is becoming significantly more Christian. Although he was sort of Christian to begin with, but I mean Christian in the Baptist sense." I didn't say that to the president, who's Presbyterian, and but very, very reformed. I mean, you get John Calvin
thrust down your throat all the time. And so, you know, when I get back on this trip, well, I'm on sabbatical at the moment, and I'll get back from this trip, there will be crates and crates of stuff waiting for me. Original manuscript of The Road Less Traveled. Award. I mean, just a whole bunch of stuff. But there's a story that Peck tells in one of his books that is my third image. It's a story about him when he was 28 years of age, a young psychiatrist in training, just finishing up his psychiatric residency, when he gets a message from the chief psychiatrist, would he please come at his earliest convenience and meet with the chief psychiatrist. He comes in, he sits down thinking, well, I wonder what the chief psychiatrist is going to thank me for. I wonder what accolades he's going to heap on my head. And the psychiatrist sits him down, somber look on his face, says to Scott Peck these words, "I want you to know you're getting near the end of your training with us. If I had my way, you would not get a certificate from this place. You don't deserve to be recognized." And he said, "And I'm going to tell you why. Others have overridden me, and so you will get your certificate. But I want you to know that I think you're about the most arrogant so-and-so that I have ever encountered. You are more incompetent than you realize. You think you're God's gift to this world. I don't think there's a single person in the 2 or 3 years of your residency here, not a single person who could honestly say, this man has helped me." And for the next hour, this was the conversation. One-sided, pulling him to pieces. And he left that meeting that day thinking he was a total failure, that he was useless, that there was nothing he could do of any value whatsoever. And for the next few months, he was in a deep, deep depression. And later on, Peck writes that this was his moment of breaking. And I love that expression. This was his moment of breaking. This was the moment that he had been waiting for all his life up to that point. At a moment when one becomes stripped of all the masks, of all the false facades, of the scaffolding one erects, of the crutches that one develops. And this moment of breaking, he says, was the moment of truth for him. The moment when he was able to look deep within himself. And for the first time got a glimpse of who he really was. I love this expression, moment of breaking. I don't think there's only one moment of breaking. There's usually one, the first one. If you're fortunate, it comes early in life. What is sad for me is when it comes late in life for someone near the end of his or her ministry, has a moment of breaking, that's sad. Everything else before that point is probably wasted. Not wasted in God's sense. God somehow uses our inadequacies. He uses our stupidity. And that's just in the nature of God. But wasted in the sense of effective personal ministry. These moments of breaking are moments of truth. A time when you achieve a level of authenticity that you did not know before. A moment when real healing takes place. There are other such moments of healing. They come. They are moments that we wouldn't seek for. We wouldn't deliberately go after. But when they come, we need to be able to recognize them for what they are. You see, there are times when the broken edge becomes the cutting edge. There are times when it's not necessary to be strong. When being weak is the best thing that could possibly happen to you. Those then are my three images, and the messages are fairly clear, I hope. Woundedness is a given. But you better be in the business of healing your woundedness, or else your ministry is not going to be effective. And thirdly, moments of breaking need to be relished. Not created, not sought over, not set up, but relished when they come. Because they will come. There will be times of failure. There will be times of apparent total abandonment by God. Moments of breaking. Now, one of the most significant problems in ministry is that it easily unbalances one's life. And whereas as it is true that every day we die a little, every day we die a little, every day a little part of me died. Last night, watching that footy game, a little part of me died. Went to bed, and part of my brain went kaput. Somebody's name vanished. You know, we're dying all the time. The question is, are we dying too fast? And unbalanced living is the critical issue. Unbalanced living. And to get balance into your life, you have to put the person back in the pastor. So point three, I want to say a few things about the person. The person has got to be put back in the pastor. There is no balanced living when the person is relegated or set off or split off to the side. The person is the primary tool that God uses in ministry. Oh, I wish I could just say it and you grasp it. Your person is the primary tool that God uses in ministry. Now, we Baptists tend to want to spiritualize it. We don't want to think that it is our person. But think for a moment with me. You know, God could have sent angels to minister the gospel. Could easily have done that. Wouldn't have depended on broken, hurting people to do that ministry. But he didn't. He sent people, and we won't know the real reason for that, and I sure am going to try and find out when I get to heaven, you know. Why people, Lord? Any idea how much misery that has caused me and others? You know, people. No, in God's mysterious way, there is a purpose. And I think that the Apostle Paul hints at that here in 2 Corinthians chapter 4. But we have this treasure in jars of clay. Jars of clay. Broken, fragile clay. To show that this all-surpassing power is from God and not from us. I think that's one reason. Probably enough of a reason. Now, real problems develop when you forget you are a person. Pastors don't get into trouble because they forget they are pastors. They get into trouble because they forget they are persons. So it's important what sort of person you are. It doesn't really matter what sort of person my bank manager is. In fact, I have no idea what his personal life is like. As long as he knows how to invest money and add up correctly. It doesn't really matter what sort of person my surgeon is. I had some surgery 15 years ago. A little bit of surgery, it wasn't a big deal. But as I was lying on the table before they put me out, I kept thinking to myself, I wonder what sort of person this guy is. What, you know, I wonder how he treats his children. I wonder what, is he quick-tempered? I wouldn't like a quick-tempered person to operate on me, really, would you? Imagine getting frustrated because you nip something, it starts to bleed. Oh, you know, and you know, I'd like him to be calm, cool, and collected, personally. But really, bottom line, it doesn't matter as long as he knows where to cut and stitch. I had a patient once who was a cardiologist, a marvelous, I mean, the best cardiologist I know. If ever I have any heart problems, in fact, my wife sees this particular
person. He's brilliant, absolutely brilliant. But his personal life is a total mess. He leaves home 5 o'clock in the morning, gets out of the house, says he's got to go and do his pre-op checks, whatever that means. Gets down to the hospital, has breakfast there, sits and reads the newspaper, checks his few patients who are going to have surgery that day, moves to his office, which is next to the hospital, sees patients all day, afternoon probably does angioplasties and stuff like that, and eats dinner. I can never figure out what is dinner and supper. And the main meal, he eats that at the hospital. And maybe 10:30, 11 o'clock at night, finally, after having read the evening newspaper, he decides to go home, goes into his house when everyone else is asleep, hardly ever sees his wife, never talks to his kids. His personal life's a total mess. Brilliant cardiologist, though. Now, I put it to you, can one be an effective pastor if one's personal life is in a mess? Of all the vocations I know, it's the one vocation that you cannot effectively do, work at, if your personal life is not in order. So it doesn't matter what sort of person you are. Now, one of the biggest difficulties in ministry is trying to be a real person. Do you know what I mean by that? Pastors have great difficulty being themselves in truth. And there are two things I want to say about that. Mainly I want to say about being a real person. I want to draw your attention to the fact that each and every one of us plays to a grandstand. After halftime last night, my adrenaline was going so high, I decided I was going to go and lie in bed and have my little radio and listen to the broadcast. Didn't make much difference, though. It's not less exciting. It's almost more exciting because now you have to visualize the game as the commentator tells it to you. But what was interesting as I listened to it on the radio was how much more noticeable to me the grandstand was. I could hear the people, their comments and talking. And someone had mentioned to me during the break how important the grandstand is in a game like this, because you really get your adrenaline kick or excitement. The player gets the adrenaline surge from the response of the grandstand to something that one has done. So you see, the footy players are always playing to the grandstand. Always. But not just footy players. We all have a grandstand. Particularly in ministry, we have a grandstand to which we play. And what's important is you should know who is in your grandstand. Now, I can tell you this. My father is in the grandstand. Is in my grandstand. And I often do something and I look up at the grandstand. Is Dad there? Can he see me? Because when I was about 11 years of age, 10 or 11 years of age, he said to me one day these words. He said, "You know, Archie, you're never going to amount to anything, don't you?" In South Africa, we call that motivation. I have an idea that it's also the Aussie way. You motivate a kid by saying, throwing down the gauntlet, "You know, you're not going to amount to anything." Now, you're supposed to get up from that encounter and go take on the world and prove or disprove your father wrong, you know. Didn't have that effect. If I'm not going to amount to anything, why try? Why bother? I want to throw in the towel. But my father was up in the grandstand. You know, I keep remembering those words. I can never amount to anything. But fortunately, my grandfather is up there also. My parents divorced when I was 12. So my father pretty much moved out of my life. My grandfather became a very significant part of my life. He was a different sort of man. He said, "You can do anything. Anything. Come with me to my workshop." My father would never let me touch his tools. My grandfather said, because we spent a lot of time with my grandfather, he lived out in the country, he said, "Come to the workshop. You have all these tools. Now, what would you like to make?" Oh, Granddad, this time of the Second World War, you couldn't buy toys. Oh, I'd love a sailboat. come on. Yes, some wood. Now, how do you think you should start? He didn't do it for me. He empowered me. He showed me how to do it. And from my grandfather, I learned there's nothing I cannot do. Do you know how precious that is to me? Nothing. May not do it well, but that's not the point. So my grandfather's in my grandstand. First boss I ever worked for was a boss from hell. You know the sort. Nothing you did was right. You know, his idea as a young engineer, a newly graduated engineer, and his idea of good supervision was you just send him back to the drawing board. Go, no, it's not right, go do it again. But what's wrong? No, you find out for yourself. An absolutely bad-tempered, could never take any bad news to him about any job that wasn't working. You took bad news to him, he chopped your head off. He just bit your head off. Boss from hell. I worked there for a while. I decided, my wife and I got married, and we moved down to Pietermaritzburg, South Africa. And I thought, wow, free of him. And then the city engineer's job became vacant in Pietermaritzburg, and who should apply for and get the job but my boss from hell? So I had to go on working for him. He's in my grandstand. He's in my... And I can go on and on. We all have a grandstand. And if you're not careful, you spend your life playing to the grandstand, doing things that you think other people want you to do, and slowly you become less and less a real person, your own person. And one of the surest signs of maturity as a pastor, one of the surest signs of maturity as a pastor, is that finally you begin to reach up into the grandstand and you say, you, out. You, out. I took my father off that, out of that grandstand a long, long time ago. There is only one person to whom one is accountable. There's only one person in the grandstand to whom you should play the game, and that is your God and Creator Himself, the one who has called you, the one who has charged you, the one who has given you a purpose for your life. And to Him and Him only are you accountable. Because if you are distracted for one moment to anyone else in that grandstand, you're doomed, you're lost. You will not fulfill your ministry. There comes a time when you have to say to everyone who has the potential to be in that grandstand, to H with all of you, get out of my face. I am accountable to God. The Apostle Paul, in 1 Corinthians, early in 1 Corinthians, I think it's chapter 2, he says that, I do not let you judge me. I don't even judge myself. Only God judges me. And there's a sense in which, the point I want to make is this, that also there's another person in that grandstand. You've got to get out of the grandstand, and that person is yourself. Because you're your hardest critic. You're your worst enemy. You are the boss from hell. Oh, to be a real person. I was speaking to a large group of Pentecostal preachers once, and I got on this topic for how difficult it is in ministry to be a real person. How difficult it is. Can't express your own opinion. Got to always second guess what others are thinking. And I said, you know, wouldn't it be wonderful if you could find a place where you could just be yourself? And a man, a pastor at the back, started sobbing. He just sobbed and sobbed and sobbed. Because we crave that. We crave it. Just to be myself. I have something more to say about that later. But trying to be a real person is followed by what I believe to be a very significant obstacle in our day and age. Very significant obstacle. It is this. We have a penchant for recycling old heresy. You've got to watch American Christian television. to get a feel for that. This is why I am such a strong believer in theological education. I wouldn't want to be a psychologist anywhere else but in a theological seminary. Because only there, you know, only in sound theology does one get to see and know God. A sick theology can never produce healthy people. Never. It takes a healthy theology. And I am such a strong advocate for theological education. And it shouldn't stop at the end of seminary training. This is why I'm committed more to our Doctor of Ministry program than I am to the School of Psychology. Because it doesn't stop there. A lot of burnout in ministry is the consequence of what a colleague of mine at Fuller calls theological anemia. Theological anemia. Your theological blood is not bright red at all. It's a pale yellow or pink or whatever. Not blood red. Not red with the blood of Christ. It's anemic. And we have this penchant for recycling old heresies, and people who don't know theology are the biggest culprits for doing that. That's why lay-led small groups have got to be monitored so very carefully, and people have to be trained so closely. That's the weakness of small group ministry, is that the theology is a theology of experience, not a theology of the Bible. It's a theology of feeling. Oh, I feel that this is how God is. Feelings have nothing to do with it, my friend. But one of the heresies, and I wish one of my theological colleagues would write a book just listing contemporary heresies that we've recycled. But one of them I'd certainly know well and have can see it a mile away is a recycled version of Gnosticism. I have it down there under D. The heresy of Gnosticism. Gnosticism is a heresy of the first century to which the Apostle John wrote his first epistle. In the ancient Gnostics believed that basically that anything that was spiritual was superior to everything else. That what you did in the spirit transcended anything you did in the mind or the flesh. Or in this world. That which was spiritual was superior. And so the Apostle John had to write his epistle to correct that. It was heretical. It was heresy. Now today, the modern version of Gnosticism goes something like this. That which is spiritual is only thing that is important. Who you are as a person is not as important as who you are spiritually. Now if we're honest as Baptists, we'll recognize this heresy. The modern version of Gnosticism says that I can be spiritual without regard to who I am as a person. And so we split off our spiritual life and we become fragmented, not multiple. There's no such thing as multiple personality, by the way. We need to correct that. We talk of it as a fragmented personality. We split it off, splitting. And there's more splitting in evangelical circles than in almost any other group I know. And we split off the personal from the spiritual. And we say, well, you see, only that which is spiritual is important. Let me illustrate this. My wife has just moved in the back there, and she won't mind me telling the story. She's chaplain to student wives at Fuller Seminary, has a wonderful ministry there, probably the most important thing that happens at Fuller Theological Seminary is what happens in those wives group meetings. But she's constantly counseling these wives of male students. We haven't yet found a person to lead a sort of male spouse equivalent. So it's mainly a ministry to wives. But she counsels these wives, and one day, one night, late at night, the telephone rang. Now, they know they're not supposed to call after 5 o'clock in the evening, because at that point I'm home. And the rule is you don't call after 5 o'clock, unless it's an absolute crisis. So this is 11 o'clock at night. It must have been a crisis. I was lying on the one side of the bed. Kath answered the phone on the other side, and I tried not to pay attention, but It's very easy when listening to one side of a conversation, you can piece together the whole story, can't you? It's very, very easily. And every now and again I could pick up a word from the telephone, and I pieced together the following story. This is a wife calling 11 o'clock at night, very distraught. Because that day, her husband, who was taking a course on prayer, 2-week intensive course on prayer, had made a pact with other members in the class to meet at 5 o'clock in the morning for prayer. You know, they hear about the Korean Christians getting up 4 o'clock in the morning every day for prayer, and you know, you have to read some of the old-fashioned literature to get this idea. And so they decided 5 o'clock in the morning they would be up, and they would pray together in small groups and together as a group until 8 o'clock in the morning when the class began. And then they would have the class, which was more didactic and lecture. And then after lunch, when the class was over, they'd go back for another 2 or 3 hours of intensive prayer. These were students committed to praying. Intercessory prayer. Personal prayer. So he'd been gone since 5 o'clock that morning. And what had happened was that at midday, when he came in through his little flat on campus, walked through the front door, his 3-year-old son ran up to his father, threw his arms around his daddy's legs, and grabbed his daddy tight and said, "Oh, daddy, 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 I'm so glad you're home, daddy." But daddy shook his leg like you would when a dog was sort of biting on the bottom of your pants. Shook his leg like this, and the little 3-year-old kid fell backwards, knocked his head, and started crying his head off. Wife, trying to understand what's going on, leans back from her kitchen sink, looks down the passage at the front door, sizes up the situation, and then says to her husband, "Oh, darling, please, you left so early this morning. He's been waiting for you all morning. You left so early. He's been waiting for you to come home. Just pick him up. Hold him. Tell him you love him. And he'll be okay." Hubby walks up to the kitchen door and puts his hands on his hips, towering above her, says these words, "You know, woman, that's your problem. You don't understand the things of God." Turns around and walks out. What he means is, I've been in prayer, steeped in prayer, since 5 o'clock this morning. Do you really think that I have the time and the patience to play and respond to a little 3-year-old's needs? You don't understand the things of God." He walked out. It's now 11 o'clock at night. She has not seen or heard from him since. And I could hear her voice faintly on the telephone at the other end of the telephone saying these words, asking this question. She's saying, "Is it true?" She's pleading. "Is it true? Is it true that I don't understand the things of God?" You know, I wanted to scream out at her and say, no, you understand the things of God. It's your husband who doesn't. That's Gnostic thinking. That the spiritual is far superior to anything else. That it's heresy. You will never convince me that who you are as a person, that you can be spiritual without regard to who you are as a person. You'll never convince me of that. If that time in prayer didn't bring him through that door as a more loving, caring father, it wasn't worth the time he spent in it. Ministry demands the utmost in maturity. We owe it to those we lead to be the healthiest we can possibly be. B. because there's no way they're going to attain to a higher level of personal wholeness than we ourselves have accomplished.